Senate Education Committee meeting. Today is Wednesday, February 1st, and the time is 8 a.m. In attendance are Co-Chair Meyer, Senator Stevens, Senator French, and myself, Senator Thomas. We have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone. First, is there anything to come before the committee before we actually kick off this morning? Seeing nothing, I would like to make an announcement, however, that there is a lunch and learn tomorrow. Dr. Mark Myers, Vice Chancellor of the Research Services for the University of Alaska. Fairbanks will give a presentation about the research projects now underway in Alaska and those on the horizon, and Mr. Dan White will also, I think he's a doctor, will also give a briefing on the potential for intellectual property development. The only item of business before us today is Senate Bill 169, which provides education funding through distance delivery for students who do not have access to courses needed for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. We are a big state, and distance delivery is one way for us to offer educational opportunities around the state. If a student wants to attend college, we want to make that possible for them. Senate Bill 169 addresses some of the difficulties a student might have as they prepare for higher education. I expect today that we'll hear the bill and hear invited testimony. I do not expect to move the bill out of committee today. So that's kind of our order of business. At this point, I'll have my staff, Faye Marie Richmond, come up and present the bill to the committee. Marie, if you would come forward, put yourself on the record.
Thank you.
And thanks your testimony.
My name is Murray Richmond, and I am the co-aide for the Senate Education Committee. 2 years ago, when we passed the Alaska Performance Scholarship Bill, we knew that there were schools and districts around the state that were not able to offer the full complement of courses for the students to be able to attain the scholarship. And there are different ways of delivering those courses, and the department has been working on distance delivery courses, and in the course of working through UAF, I found they also have a distance delivery program. The difference is theirs is dual college credits, and I'll explain more about that a little bit later. But essentially what we're offering here is that if a student lives in an area where the courses are not being offered, they are then able to enroll for a dual high school college credit that will be good at their high school for the scholarship, and when they get to school, they'll have a college credit under their belt. Some studies have shown that when students come in with college credits already, they tend to do better at college, and there are attempts to have early college high schools all over the country now as charter schools, because at-risk kids are much more likely to go on and succeed at college if they go in with college credits under their belt versus going in and taking a year of remedial work and getting no credit for that. So what I want to do is walk you through the bill this morning. As is often the case when you try to craft legislation for a somewhat complicated and varied subject, it can get kind of hard to deal with all the specifics, and so there's some changes that will be needed to be made to this bill, and we'll talk some about what those could possibly be and then hear from the committee on what you would like to see. The bill funds this through the funding formula currently. That may or may not be the best way to do it, but is the way that we could maintain perpetual funding for these students. It could be through another means, and we probably hear more about that later as we talk about this bill, but in the funding formula, we're sure that they will continue to get these funds. That's a one-size-fits-all solution, and there are some problems with that, and I'll raise some of those as we get further into it. Changes, the Section 1 basically amends the part that deals with outlining who gets money in the funding formula, and if you look on page 2, this changes the statutes on line 5D. The number obtained for intensive services under AS 14-17-402, and then it adds the number obtained for distance delivery courses under AS 14-07. So this will change the ADM in a school district. And I'll show you how on the next area. If you look at page 3, starting on line 17, as a component of public school funding, a district is eligible for distance delivery funding and the amount obtained by multiplying a factor of 0.5 by the number of students who enroll in one or more distance delivery courses. And in common language, what that means is if a school has a student that's enrolled in a distance delivery course that I'm going to describe below. That student counts basically as a student and a half. So they, you, a school would get a half a BSA for that student who's enrolled to pay for the distance delivery. When a student takes courses through the University of Alaska system, they have to pay full credit for that. And just so you know what some of those costs are, a three-credit math course would be run $430. That's the simple way of doing it. They can go up to a four-credit science course is $580. The six-credit courses, which is the one that the one of our invited witnesses is going to talk about today, is $870 tuition plus a kit that costs $500. It's a science course. And then travel for the student or the instructor. Either the instructor goes out or the student goes to a common site, and that can run up to $1,000. And previously, this has been billed to the university, and the district. Previously, this is billed to the district or to the student. We have students who do this now in Fairbanks. Most of them have parents that work at UAF, and so they get free tuition. So if a high school student takes a UAF course, they have to pay UAF fees, and this ensures that the district and the student won't have to pay those fees. So that makes it a high school education more open to everybody. Not everybody is eligible for this, and this is where we've had some problems in getting the bill crafted in such a way that we limit it the way we want to. This 0.5 of a student only comes if the course they're taking is a required course for the scholarship. That's a number one on line 22. Line 24, number 2, the district provides the course to the student only by distance delivery. In other words, the student can't take the course on site. Number 3, an accredited post-secondary institution located in the state provides the course. The in the state part keeps one of the for-profit universities in the lower 48 coming in and scooping up our students when we've got programs up here they can take. And then it defines distance delivery courses.
If you could pass out the
changes. In talking with the department, what we discovered was these may not be limiting enough. For instance, they could foresee a scenario where a district might stop offering a course, like a science course, and just let it be done distance delivery and then get the money for it. And so we've tried to refine that even further, and this is our first attempt at it. The proposed changes would replace, in a committee substitute, lines 22 through 30 on page 3. And it would start the same. The course is part of the core academic curriculum courses required for eligibility under the scholarship. The district has not provided the course on site for at least the two previous years to the student. So if, as the scenario was given to us, Anchorage decides to do away with foreign language requirements, because that is one of the requirements, it would be 2 years before they could get any money for their students to do that. If Fairbanks decided to get rid of their math and have it offer distance delivery, it would be 2 years before they could get any money to send students to do a distance delivery. Most of these schools have not been offering these courses for at least 2 years, and so that would not affect any school that is currently offering the course, that does not have the courses. And if we don't want to encourage schools to stop offering courses. We want them to ramp up. But this is a stopgap measure before they're able to do that. Number 3, no other courses offered on site by the district will satisfy the curriculum requirement. That would be if you wanted 4 science courses and you wanted to take astronomy, your school offered physics, but you really wanted to do astronomy, and you said, well, they don't offer astronomy. Well, that the student could not do that. They would have to take the physics course. We would not pay for them to take an alternative science course if there's already a course that satisfies the requirement. And then the accredited post-secondary institution located in the state provides the course. In the packet that you've gotten, just to go over a few short things, and then I'm going to turn it over to our invited witnesses, you'll see the fiscal note. Currently, it is an indeterminate fiscal note, and that is the department was kind enough to give us some leeway on this. The original fiscal note, because they felt it did not limit the number of students who could take this course sufficiently was estimated to be fairly large. So currently it's an indeterminate fiscal note until we can get a better handle on how many students would actually be taking this course. The second page of the fiscal note just goes into more of the bill and what it intends to do. The next page, which says Governor Performance Scholarship Math and Science four-year course offerings, that's the page with the square, talks about the schools and districts that currently cannot offer the courses for the scholarship. This was one of the, this was from 2010, and it was one of the handouts when we were studying the scholarship bill. There are currently 16 schools that offer just two math courses and 16 that offer just three math courses. And there are 32 schools that offer just two science courses and 33 that offer just three science courses. There's a total, there's seven overlaps, so there's a total of 80 schools that currently do not offer the courses needed for the scholarship. And all those students at those schools are not able to avail themselves of those courses. The next is a document from one of the people who's testifying, and if he wants to refer to that, I will let him do that. The third is a little square sheet like this that has figures are the number of course credits currently done by dual delivery, 292 course credits, most of them through UAF's CTC, Career Technical College. And perhaps one of our invited witnesses will go further into this. The last thing I want to go over in the package is the study in here. It's from Oregon. And the only thing I really want to highlight here is the part that's highlighted on your page in yellow. A 2010 study completed by Oregon University System showed that students who participate in dual credit programs are more successful in college. It makes a little sense. The student is actually doing college work early. They don't have that high school college barrier to overcome, and they're already coming in with college credits. And this would be a dual college program. The last, after this report, is a report from Texas on how they do dual credits. And then is the PowerPoint after that, the color part, which our invited witness will take you through this morning. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Murray, for your presentation, and I'd also like to make sure that we indicate that we've been joined by Vice Chair Davis. Welcome. Good morning. And I realize that's kind of a quick run-through, but we wanted to get this up and before the committee because we're looking for comments. We're still trying to refine some issues, as Murray indicated, particularly the distance delivery and what is available and what is lacking at this point in time, and that's led somewhat to the indeterminate fiscal note. So. With that, are there any initial questions for Mr. Richmond? Senator Meyer.
I do. thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Thank you, Murray, for that presentation. My question is how these type of classes relate to the AP type classes in that currently high schools have, because I know the AP classes mm-hmm. also count as college credit. And I don't know who pays for those, if it's the schools or the
issue. My understanding, and I could be wrong here, is that the schools offer the courses. If the student wants to take the test to get the college credit, then they have to pay that. Okay. That's coming from my memory of my daughter taking those courses. So there are people here from the administration that could probably answer that question more accurately than I could.
Well, I think, though, an AP class is an actual class, and then you take a test afterwards, and then if you get a decent grade, you get college credit for it.
That part I can attest to from my daughter's experience.
Yes.
Okay. The chair.
And then I'll have other questions for the administration. I know we addressed these classes that were required to get a scholarship, and we knew that some of the rural areas in particular would not offer these classes. And I'm thinking that was their recommendation as well as these distance learning programs, in which case hopefully they'll be supportive of your bill, or Senator Thomas.
Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole presentation. But one thing that flipped through my mind as you were talking about it, had to do with, and I like the idea that students from small schools, small high schools, can find a way to get a, this class through distance delivery. But I just wanted to just ask you a question about, you know, we have something like 15 campuses around around the state or something like that, and why would we not allow students to take an on-site class rather than force them to take distance delivery class if their school did not offer the class they wanted? It seems to me we shouldn't care how they go about doing it. Is any response to that?
Through the chair, and I think our witnesses might speak more to this later, but if a student doesn't live in that area, they're going to be doing it some part of the course by distance anyway. And the courses that are designed through the College of Rural Development are specifically designed to be taught in bush communities, you know, for both high school and college students.
Well, I guess my question is, are there other schools other than just rural schools that are not able to offer some of the classes that are needed? I mean, I'm thinking of like a maybe in, say, Sitka, where they have a community college.
Through the chair, this would not preclude them from doing that.
Well, no, it would. It would say you couldn't take it by, except by distance delivery.
This bill would not fund them to take that. Now, I will make a note of that, and we could look and make sure that that's part of the process.
Okay, thank you. So.
And that will be part of that will be part of what we figure out just here as we're struggling with exactly what areas of the state are not able to get distance delivery, and I think there are 18 rural campuses. Dr. Joseph will certainly bring us up to speed on that number, and we'll sort through that, because that there is probably no good reason that we wouldn't want to do that. Thank you. And Hollis,
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I totally get the idea behind the bill, and I totally support it, but I just need to understand a little bit better how it works. It's coming to me for the first time this morning. This is for high school students who are not offered the courses they need to qualify for the scholarship in their home high school.
With the chair, that is correct.
Okay. And we are going to offer the school district up to half of the base student allocation because they can't get those classes in their home high school.
Through the chair, that is correct.
That's on top of the base student allocation they're getting to begin with.
That is correct.
It's a factor of half. And it doesn't adjust. That is, it's just a 0.5 number. So you could get, if the base student allocation is, let's just pick a number, $55,000, let's just use that. You could get $2,500 for a student who's taking one distance delivery class.
That is correct, through the chair.
Okay, and I just, you know, I guess I just have to say that seems, we need to work on that idea, because that just seems to give the district an incentive, I mean, a strong financial incentive to push kids to one distance delivery class that costs $430 from the university.
Through the chair, that is one of the things that we are looking at. And
okay.
The problem is that the range of courses could be from close to $2,500 to $430.
All the way down,
so
right.
Coming up with a one-size-fits-all.
And I totally get how difficult it is to sort of write down, you know, on a piece of paper the wide variety of experiences that the school districts face in the real world, particularly in Bush, Alaska. I mean, we're not talking about Anchorage and Fairbanks and Sitka, really. We're out in smaller communities where the kids, you know, absolutely deserve the exact same chance that the students in my West High School district have to go and get the scholarship. So I totally appreciate the sentiment. I'm not pushing back on the idea. I'm just wanting to make sure I understand how it works. And so I guess I'll be, like the rest of the committee, listening and thinking about how to, sort of bring it right into the dollar amount without too much bureaucracy.
Through the chair, that's what we were trying to avoid, was having
right.
a billing system that
right.
became Byzantine.
Right, right. Thank you.
Thank you. And that obviously is an issue we've looked at, and we're trying to refine how you actually approach more realistically the actual costs versus just having something that may be formula-driven. But like I said, we're working on that.
It's the debut performance here.
That's right.
Doing
exactly.
Part.
Thankfully, it's well received, at least the concept, the basic premise. Any other questions at this point in time? If not, let's see. We do have online to talk about distance delivery programs through the University of Alaska, Vice Chancellor Dr. Bernice Joseph, and also Rural and Community Development and and Dr. Dan Soli, who teaches distance delivery courses to rural Alaska. Do we have you both on online? Are you there this morning, doctors?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, and congratulations to you, Dr. Joseph, on I think what is a fairly recent doctorate that you received.
I'm just actually in the final stages of my dissertation.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't confer that upon you, so I guess I should wait before I use that.
We could probably do that.
Yes, we could. Who says we can't? That's right.
Got to be optimistic.
All right. With that in mind, you guys go ahead and figure out who's going first there. I'm not sure if you're going first, Dr. Joseph, or not, but please go forward with your put yourself on the record, of course, and go forward with your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Senators Meyer and Thomas, for this opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Bernice Joseph, and I'm the Vice Chancellor and Executive Dean for the College of Rural and Community Development. And I'm here to speak in support of SB 169 for many of the reasons that Murray just stated. To give you a little bit of background on the campuses that we have in the system, there are 15 community campuses, six of which are under the University of Alaska Fairbanks and are located in strategic hubs across the state. We have campuses, UAF campuses in Dillingham, Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and five centers throughout the interior through the Interior Aleutians campus in Fort Yukon, Galena, Onalaska, McGrath, Nenana, Hope, and of course the Community and Technical College in downtown Fairbanks. The idea of tech prep and dual credits is not new to what we've been doing here at the College of Rural and Community Development, but we've definitely picked up our efforts in that area over the last 3 years, and this provides, of course, a great head start for students in high school to earn both college credits while meeting their high school graduation needs. And also, by doing these courses, many of which are in the core curriculum, can work towards their general studies degree, which can articulate then into a bachelor's degree. So I believe you have the PowerPoint presentation that Murray referenced. And if you go to page 2 on the introductory slide, there's information that are on the rural student need. Again, much of what Murray addressed. And I just want to bring your attention to the third bullet, and this is the work that Dr. Soli prepared, so he can speak to that. But it was impressive to see the number of students who graduated from secondary schools with 10 or fewer graduates in 2011. So there was 548. Roughly 350 of those rural graduates came from the CRCD region. And by that we mean through the campuses and those strategic hubs across the state. We reach out to about 160 communities, the largest being the Kuskokwim campus in Bethel, which serves about 55 communities, and the Interior Aleutians campus, which serves about 56 communities. So if you turn to the following page under the UA dual credit distance delivery, you'll see that we do offer dual credit courses through our community campuses. And one of the efforts that we've been working on over the last 2 years is the collaborative teaching model, where we're working, we initially did work with the Bristol Bay region, the Dillingham schools, where we had our math faculty, Dr. Victor Zinger, work with high school teachers within the region to train them in the pedagogy and delivery of math using distance ed modalities. And that worked quite well out there, so we're expanding those efforts across regions now. And now Dr. Zinger is currently working with the Northwest Arctic Borough on teacher training for students within that district. So we talked, there was conversation about the UA tuition cost, and that's really a barrier for many of our rural high school students. And we're seeing that, especially now with the long, cold winter that we've had, and, you know, many students who have to choose to work to, of course, heat their homes versus enroll in a course. So tuition support for them to attend and be able to take higher ed credits would be essential for success. And the SB 169 addresses that tuition need for the rural students. You know, there, as I think it was Senator Stevens said, that there are opportunities in the urban areas through the AP courses, but those often are not available in the remote communities across the state. So given that, I'd like to now turn it over to Dr. Soley for a topic that he's been working on and refining over the last few years.
Thank you, Bernice. I just wanted to spend just a brief moment talking about where I see the reason I'm really supportive of this bill, and that that comes from my background of,
for the record,
and through the chair. Pardon me. I worked for a number of years. I've taught introductory physics courses here at UAS, and also I have run the Alaska Native Science and Engineering program at UAF for a number of years, up through 2008. And one of the things I saw is that students from small schools in small villages were often at a disadvantage when they reached the university, and especially their math and science preparation, if they wanted to go on into these into engineering or into the sciences especially. And so we developed a course to help bring those skills up, especially math and physics, the reasoning and problem solving. And that's really the motivation. Now there are a number of other courses that we offer here. The distance math courses that are offered through through CRCD. The one of the key things in many of these courses is the interaction, the real-time interactivity of the course. And there's technology now. One specific software is called eLive, where it's essentially a whiteboard where the teacher can talk. The students see what the teacher writes, and they can interact. And Sandra Wildflower, a math professor here, has been using that method very effectively for a number of years, as have many of the other professors here. And their success rates with students are much higher. And in one course in particular, which I think is very indicative of this need, roughly 30% of the students in her developmental Math 105 class, which is equivalent to high school Algebra 2, roughly a third of those students are high school students from small schools. And those students have a very high success rate in her classes. I'll move from that. We have a number of different models, but what we did with the physics course is try to introduce a course, develop a course that fits the lifestyle in Bush, Alaska, and also fits the needs of the students there, and to also make it interesting. And so we introduced basic physics, but we use examples that are familiar to the students. Instead of cars on a highway, we use snow machines, something as simple as that, to and introduce cultural ideas, oftentimes not overtly, but they're there. It's part of the background of the course. And we stress problem solving. We use direct video conference connection, and that's an issue because there are very few schools that, have the bandwidth necessary at this point. But it's a way to get direct connection with the students. And we use the other tools that the university has available for distance and online course delivery. And then we have tutorial sessions that we work with the students. This course bridges the semesters so that, and it's a late start. Students can start the course after moose hunting season. And the course ends early, at the end of April, so that students are done before graduation and so on. It allows us the flexibility of fitting many different school districts and many different and the vagaries of living in rural Alaska. When the fuel runs out and the school freezes for a few days, we've got the flexibility to be able to handle those with individual students. And a key thing for high school students in this course is it's 6 credits, since it's bigger than a normal 4-credit lab course. And so that translates to 1 high school science credit. The additional piece is delivering the laboratory component. And one critical issue for science classes is a laboratory experience for those students. And that's a difficult thing to do at a distance. There's a lot of talk about it, but to actually give the student a real experience and give them the tutoring and give them the instruction that they need to be able to really understand what they're doing is difficult. And so what we've done is broken that lab component into 3 pieces, which is described on the next page of the PowerPoint. And we have little we send out a lab kit, and that's what Murray had referred to as being roughly $500. Now, that's reusable. So that's a one-time cost, and we're covering the expenses of this course right now. It's grant-funded, and we've developed it under grants. And so the travel and the cost of the kits and so on is covered by a grant right now. But those are those run out, and the writing in the future is not good out of the federal government. But those lab kits, the students then do these little, fairly simple experiments, but they do them themselves. And then the second piece is crucial for student success at the university, is understanding how to put together, in a lab class especially, how to put together a lab report, what's all involved in a laboratory experiment. And that's where we have the students work with someone who's qualified. Now, it might be a teacher that's there at a school or a nearby school. Or it might be someone who's an engineer who works in the town. That we've done in the past. Generally, it's either myself or the graduate teaching assistant from physics who works with me will go out to that school and spend a couple of days there. Now, the key thing in doing that is that teacher not only spends time with the students in the class, but during that time that they're in this small school, and remember, these are generally small schools that do not have someone who's got a lot of science training. They probably have a teacher who's got a degree in generally biology, but that's really the maximal, oftentimes, as much science training as they've had. You become, if you go out there, you become the resident scientist, and you spend a significant time with your student or students, but then the rest of the time you're acting as scientists in residence in the school. And that's a way in which we get science out to these schools. It's sort of the itinerant teacher model is what we've incorporated into this. And then the third piece of the laboratory experience is students work with other groups in the class remotely, and they discuss their data. And what they're doing is they're measuring the angle of the sun and determining their latitude. And then by working with other groups and determining the distance between the two sites, they can determine the circumference of the Earth. So it's taking simple physical measurements and learning something global. And those are the 3 components we have in the lab, in the lab segment for this course. On the next transparency of the map of the state, you all of course know the state. This is some of the sites that we've delivered this course to, and we had a student over at Iqaluit Way in eastern Canada 1 year, who was connected in. So we can deliver it quite widely, We have the capability of delivering it to more small schools, and this is something that I think can work at least pieces of this can be used in other distance delivery courses that we will probably be developing here at the university. and maybe not just this model, but pieces of this. And so I just wanted to give you an idea of the kind of the scope of what we're trying to do and how we're trying to meet this particular high school need in the rural areas. And I will say one more thing about the funding. At this point, the funding is grant funding, and I would one way to possibly get at the details of the funding needs are to encourage groups of students in a particular school. Maybe when you've got two or three in a school that can take a particular course, that would reduce the overall cost and make the funding model more efficient, more effective, if there were more than one student taking a course. But that's just one option. The additional thing is very often these small schools can only offer a course once every 2 years, maybe even 3 years. And very importantly, the quality of the course, and especially in these upper-level math courses and science courses, chemistry or physics, probably is not at the level that prepares the student for the transition into college. And that's actually something to keep in mind. The course may be on the books, but it may not be offered very often, and it also may not be of the quality or the rigor that's really necessary for the students.
I believe this concludes our presentation.
Yes.
We'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
Okay, very good. We appreciate the presentation. Do we have questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
I'm trying to get my head around the costs here. Now, I understand many districts, or at least I know my district, a high school student from, say, Kodiak High School can take a dual credit class at the college, and the district pays for it. Yet we're saying if you are a village student in a small school that doesn't have a teacher or a class, that the district will not pay for a class by audio conference or whatever the terminology is. I guess I'm trying to figure out what difference is there. I mean, if the district is going to pay, and I guess this is a question of the for the districts. If the district is going to pay for a student to take a class on campus at a campus of the University of Alaska, why are they not willing to pay for a distance ed class? Am I missing the point here? Anyway, do you have any response to that?
Through the chair, this is Bernice. And there are different models for each of the districts, and we're finding out that, of course, no two are alike. And the model that we have going with the Northwest Arctic Borough is a one-third, one-third, one-third model where the students pay a third, the district pays a third, and we pick up a third with existing grants. Now, many of the students who are enrolled through, like, Raven or IDEA or other alternative high schools have the option of doing a dual college credit to a certain amount. And I just speak from experience of my own daughter who graduated from Raven School, where they paid a portion of the tuition, and we had to pick up the other half of the tuition. So the models are different within each district.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that's a question we need to ask the districts. You know, we do fund education. We do give a certain amount for every student. And in some instances, districts do pick up the costs for students going to a class at the university. I just need to understand why is it so much more expensive to do these classes than it is a class that you're actually attending. So I just need to have the districts explain that. I mean, I think it's a great idea. I like what we're trying to accomplish here, but we need to find out, I guess, the fiscal issues is how it really does work.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. And I agree, and that's what we're struggling with right now is not only figuring out what is available and how it gets there, the cost of it, obviously, and how it can be expanded, and that's really the issue. And so we appreciate your testimony and would like to have from you your ideas and maybe a little more detail on some of what you are doing to date, not necessarily necessarily exactly what you're presenting, but how you're going about it as we try and put together then merge the information from the potential for delivery as well as the content, et cetera. It's still a big question, as you can tell from some of the questions, regarding how we would even accomplish this at a reasonable cost. So that's what we're looking for, and anything you could help us with would be greatly appreciated, just to know what you're able to do at this point in time as we merge with what other potential exists that's not actually being used. So we appreciate your testimony. Do you have any other last-minute things that you might want to add to the conversation?
Through the chair, this is Daniel Stolle again. I wanted to reiterate what Bernice said about the variability of payment for students. And this is one of the things that this bill would address, is try to level that playing field. We do have students, we try to cover with students with grants when they can't, when they don't have the ability, but it's really quite variable and quite difficult at times to cover some students. Because as you said, some districts cover if they take a college class, whether it's in, like in Bethel, or a distance class, but others don't. And that's one of the things that we're hoping that this bill does address is level things more effectively. Thank you.
And thank you. And that information would be helpful for us. So if you could put your heads together there and maybe get that to us, that'll help us kind of refine our numbers and look at what is practical and reasonable to be doing. And we'll be back in touch with you to follow up on some of those issues and refine our request maybe a little more. Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Let's see. Yeah, this is not an easy subject matter. As we tried to develop the bill, we found out that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye here. So, but we. Pardon me? I think, yeah, we plan to do that. I believe that. Like I said, it's a difficult project at best, and most of it is just simply the physical aspect of getting connected up. That's a big part of it that we're trying to explore, and we've actually had some discussions with potential folks that would deliver the types of systems just to see where they're at as far as the connectivity, you know, to the rural areas. Let's see. If there are no other questions, let's see. Next, we have anybody in the room? We did want to hear from the administration, potentially, if you had anything that you'd care to add to it at this point in time. I realize there's indeterminate fiscal note. Not necessarily interested in hearing much about that, but if you've developed, since our last conversations, any things that you would like to impart to the committee, because we've had a couple conversations, so if you wouldn't mind or you care to, we ask us some questions at this point or give us some further information on some of the discussions we've had. We have a limited amount of time left here, as some have other meetings at 9 o'clock, but we'll be glad to hear from you as we try and develop our plan here.
For the record, Elizabeth Noodleman, Director of School Finance at Department of Education. Good morning, Chair Thomas and committee members. Primarily, we are here to answer any questions in this discussion of this good topic of distance delivery. I would take just one moment to remind the committee of the calculation for the foundation formula and how this item fits in it right now. And our foundation formula distributes funding as discretionary funding to the districts in one pot of money. And one of the challenges here is that foundation funding does not follow the student. And so this proposal, one of the places that we'll want to continue to look at it is how to follow a student with categorical funding if that is what is decided upon. And so I just did want to roll back and mention the foundation formula and be available for questions.
Also, Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education, for the record. I did want to follow up on Senator Meyer's question about AP courses and confirm Murray's knowledge is my working knowledge from working in a school that AP courses are offered by districts. Districts often have to do professional development and train their teachers because you have to be trained to provide an AP course. You can't just pick up the materials and go. And then typically students pay the fee for the test that then makes them eligible for the college credit. There may be districts who pay part of that fee. I don't know that. The districts that I worked in, the student paid the fee to actually take the course. The only other thing that I wanted to mention is that I think the questions that you've raised here, and in addition with what Director Nudelman has mentioned, really has raised the questions we've raised. I don't think there's anything that did not come up here that wasn't a concern that we had a discussion with Senator Thomas and his staff about. And, you know, again, it's really around how do you narrow this or limit this so it hits the population you want to hit. Are the costs the right costs for what you're really going to incur costs around? And then, you know, is the foundation the place that you want to put something like this or not? And so I don't think there's anything new that we would add that wasn't actually discussed today unless there's questions.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, and Mr. Chairman, and I think it's good that Elizabeth reminded us that the foundation formula is discretionary. We fund the districts at whatever level we think is right per student, and they use their discretion on how they spend that money. And it's not fair. The amount of money it takes for a special ed student is much more than it may take for another student. It is a district responsibility to make sure that the students have the classes that they need. I guess I'm a little hesitant to let them off the hook on that, you know, and maybe we need to increase the foundation formula, and that's fine, and we have done that. I'm a little concerned about going in there and mixing up things and sort of taking that responsibility away from the districts to make sure that their students are ready to apply for these scholarships. That's just my thought at this point.
Very good. Senator Meyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And follow up on that, when we were having the discussions about the scholarship, and we knew some of the rural areas, villages, wouldn't have the courses to be eligible for the performance scholarships. And I know that was a concern of some of our Senate members in passing the bill itself. If we don't use a program like this, what is your idea on how we're going to get these 4 years of math, 4 years of science out to the rural areas?
Well, if I might, through the chair, Senator Meyer, start with we did have a number of districts that did not have eligible APS students this year, Alaska Performance Scholarship students. So the first thing that the commissioner did with that information is called each of those district superintendents. And to date, he's talked about that very topic to all but one of them. I believe we had 13 districts that didn't have anyone eligible. Some cases, there were no eligible. There were no kids in the cohort. There weren't any because the district was so small. But in most other cases, there were kids. In those cases, what he did not hear from any of them, it was about limited courses, and where there were limited courses, I remember him talking to me specifically about Pelican. They actually budget each year for so much for distance education. So I don't know if they're one of those districts that fully pay for distance courses or they're one of the one-third, one-thirds, but they've been making money available. Another district that he mentioned that they set aside each money is Chatham School District, because they said there's some courses that they work with via distance. But again, I don't know if they're fully paying that or what they're doing. I just know that they put some of that money in their budget. So I did want to mention districts are doing this. The other piece that you'll see is in our budget request this year, we do have an increment for a program that, as we work through the budget subcommittee, we're going to be unveiling in detail, called the Alaska Learning Network, which is a distance delivery option that we'll make available. It isn't college courses necessarily, so I want to be clear about that, but the intent is to offer advanced courses that kids need for the APS. And actually, the way we offered the first set of courses, which this is actually being ran by a district, a collection of districts right now, the way they figured out the course offerings for this current year, which there are a number of courses being offered, was based on surveying the districts to find out what courses can't you obtain that you need for the APS. Interestingly, language courses is what was coming up a lot in those cases, but there are some other math courses available. So that's a solution we're going to be putting forward through our budget process this year. We don't, though, think that's just a solution for the APS. We think that there may be other needs. There may be opportunities to augment that. Right now, if districts are doing that, they are paying for a portion of that. They have to pay to take those courses. Or the eventual idea is that there be a, sort of a trading system. You contribute a course, you get so many kids that can take a course. In other words, if you have a teacher that's willing to design a curriculum and make it available to the Alaska Learning Network, and that district gets something back for that contribution. So those kinds of things are being contemplated with that work.
Okay, good. Thank you for that response. I did want to make sure there was some kind of mechanism in place to make sure all kids had an equal opportunity at the Alaska Performance Scholarship, and it sounds like you've addressed that without having to go to a program like is suggested here. Thank you.
Senator French.
Just a follow-up question, and Senator Meyer's question anticipated mine, which is really, you know, how do we make sure that every Alaskan high school student, you know, if we're going to hold the scholarship out there as a opportunity, they have to be, you know, given a fair chance at that, and that means getting the courses. The Alaska Learning Network sounds like a good idea. Would they be courses offered by who would be the sort of entity providing the material?
Well, right now, we're designing courses. The plan is to design our own courses, and within 2 years, we'll have 30 different courses. To start the program last year, this group of districts that started this, they actually are working with a vendor that has courses, and then the network hired Alaska teachers to teach those. So the vendor is actually an out-of-state vendor, but the idea is to replace those out-of-state vendor courses with Alaska-designed courses. Also, it would lower the cost, but it makes the courses be more unique to Alaska. The one course that's already in the system and being utilized that is fully Alaska-developed is an Alaska Studies course. It was contributed by the Anchorage School District that had a course and were willing to work with the network to contribute their course. And so that's the first Alaska course, but we're in the process of developing some, and I was told that within 2 years the plan would be to have 30 Alaska unique courses that would be delivered by certified Alaska teachers, you know, K-12 that hold their certificate, but they're doing distance education.
And so for the student, the student's experience is to log onto a website and watch a, are you just watching videotapes? Are you listening to, watching a sort of a live lecture over the internet? Just tell me a little bit about how that works.
Through the chair, Senator French, my understanding, and I will probably need to provide you more detail, but my understanding is that it's a combination of things. So you may log on and have an online lesson and may have a small video clip, because one of the challenges that we're trying to work through is the broadband issues in some areas. And that's expanding. Hopefully it will continue. But that's so it may involve video clip. It may involve sort of an e-learning module that has sort of a directed PowerPoint that takes you through things. But then there's also available certified teachers for you to ask questions of. And then the intent over time was that it would be dynamic enough that sometimes you're taking course in that mode, but other times part of the thinking was that there would be the opportunity to take a course where if everyone could be taking it at the same time, you could actually engage with the instructor at that time, typically when those things are done in this type of a distance learning method, you also record them so that one can go back and look at them, or someone who missed the course can, the class can follow up.
Sure, thanks. And I'll just offer a comment. It looks like it's pointed in the right direction. I guess I have a bias, for lack of a better word, in favor of our university. You know, the idea of using an outside vendor, you know, sort of raises little, you know, hairs on the back of your neck, but if it's cost-effective, it's cost-effective. My just thumbnail sketch on the problem is you've got, according to the slides we heard earlier, you've got 548 students who are sort of coming out of tiny high schools that need some help. If it were $1,000 a year per student, it's $500,000. I don't know what the projected cost of the Alaska Learning Network is, or, you know, of course, we have an indeterminate fiscal note here, but it doesn't seem like it's a huge amount of money at stake. It's just tricky, and it seems like it's a problem we're all concerned about, and I hope we are able to, you know, at the end of this year, say we are offering every class that every Alaskan high school student needs to qualify for the scholarship. You just can't offer that scholarship and then not offer the courses. That's my kind of bottom line.
Thank you, Senator Prince. Senator Stevens.
Can I just correct something I said, Mr. Chairman? I didn't really mean when it came out, but you know, the fact that we have a foundation formula that each student is, we're given money to each district based on per student, but that money is not spent, I said fairly, I meant equitably. You know, some students may receive, you know, if we give each student, say, $4,000 to a district, one student may cost $10,000 for one student, and it may cost $2,000 for another student. So it's fairness is not what I was trying to get at. It's equitability. And to realize that that in a perfect world, we would fund foundation formula to cover this issue. And I realize we're now trying to deal with the foundation formula going through the increase that is going to have some difficulty, and I realize folks are trying to find other ways to go around it. But in principle, this belongs in the foundation formula, I think.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, we'll close the meeting today. Our next meeting will be Friday the 3rd. At February 3rd at 8 a.m. here in the Belts Room. We will hear the Alaska Performance Scholarship Outcomes Report from the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education and the annual report of the State Board of Education. So with that, if there's nothing else, we're adjourned.